like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Bronwyn Dickey, the author of Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. It's hard to think of a more polarizing issue in the animal world, or even more broadly than that, than the pit bull. As longtime listeners to this show know, when it comes to these dogs, people are rarely indifferent. Whether someone is pro-pit bull or anti, there's typically great passion involved. After she and her husband adopted a pit bull-type dog, Dickey, a journalist and contributing editor at Oxford American, who's also written for the New York Times, Newsweek, and Slate, couldn't reconcile the sweet dog now sharing their home with the villainized reputation of the pit bull as an aggressive, biting, fighting machine. So she embarked on a journalistic quest for 7 years, and has now fashioned a comprehensive exploration of how pit bull dogs became so demonized, examining the various factors, societal, race, class, political, media, others, traversing 19th century New York dogfighting through the attitudes reflected about pits and Katrina's animal rescue efforts and beyond. We'll find out more about this book and the universe of the pit bull when I speak with Bronwyn Dickey in just a moment here on Talking Animals. Also later in the program, I'll speak briefly with Linda Hamilton, Executive Director of Animal Coalition of Tampa, or ACT, in advance of Saturday's Spaghetti Dinner fundraiser. This one notable in a few ways, including that a favorite WMNFer will host the evening. We'll reveal that in a few minutes. I need to mention one more thing that's just around the corner, by which I mean the WMNF Summer Fun Drive starts 3 weeks from today, June 1st. So on that very day, if tradition holds, I'll be looking to raise a ridiculously large amount of money in less than an hour. I will have books, DVDs, special concert tickets, and more for your pledge and support of Talking Animals. But it'd be wonderful if you went to the Talking Animals tip jar right now at WMNF.org and donated on our behalf. Right now, why not? Right now, though, let's meet Bronwyn with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Bronwyn Dickey to Talking Animals. Good morning, Bronwyn.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So congratulations on the book. It only came out yesterday, and it's already been pretty celebrated, earning rave reviews and other kudos. And one of the things cited by many of the reviewers, and I was certainly struck by this, is the scope of the book and how even-handed it is. To what extent did you envision when you first began the project ultimately achieving this sort of breadth?
I'm not exactly sure. I knew there was a lot that I wanted to touch on. I knew I wanted there to be kind of three main threads to the book. I wanted there to be a historical thread where we follow kind of the evolution of the dogs over time. I wanted there to be a scientific thread where we look at kind of the intricacies of canine behavioral genetics and how we sometimes misinterpret those or kind of misrepresent the old nature-nurture debate. And I also wanted there to be a social thread, kind of about how our own perceptions of each other have affected how we've seen these dogs over time.
In developing those three threads, I'm going to guess that at some point after you'd started down the path, there might have been a moment, maybe a light bulb moment, where you're like, oh my God, this is a much bigger project than I might have envisioned. Like, I'm sort of down the rabbit hole, and now what? I mean, was there a moment like that where you thought, oh my God, to get my arms around this is going to be obviously years in the making?
I can't even tell you. There were many of those moments. Pretty much felt like that every day. Because every time I found some new piece of information, it led me to 5, 10, 15, 100 other pieces of information that I found equally interesting. And in the end, there was so much I still had to leave out. So that was really a challenge, wrangling it all together, making it a cohesive story, making it readable, and making it just kind of an enjoyable adventure for people to to come along with.
I can only imagine there must have been some times where you thought, you know what, why am I not instead working on a travel article or a scuba diving piece or whatever, something sort of small and valuable but not so sprawling, because it just seems like, yeah, just to, again, tackle that. And then it does feel like, even with what's there, and I can't imagine what you left out because it covers so much ground, and it feels like it should be, I guess it's, what, 300-something pages, but it feels like it should be two or three times that in terms of all the stuff that's covered. So I guess you really did chisel away and just keep it succinct, even though you covered all those threads, and each of those threads took you on a pretty broad path. So I've been thinking, in some ways, that the thing that launched you down this path is emblematic in some ways of the very issues that make the subject of pit bulls murky and difficult. Can you talk about kind of your own dog, or at least one of them at home, that was the impetus for this?
Sure. Well, the original kind of idea stuck in my head even before we got Nola, our kind of adopted, our shelter dog, who was labeled a pit bull. It actually started back in 2008, and I had always grown up being afraid of pit bulls. I didn't know anything about them other than to stay away from them. And I knew so little that I had always assumed that if you had a pit bull, it was some kind of tacit endorsement of dog fighting. I mean, that's how little I knew. And then, of course, some good friends of mine introduced me to their dog, and she was wonderful. She really upended all these expectations I had about what a pit bull was and what it should be and how it should behave. And so I wondered, just out of my own curiosity, I figured, you know, is she an outlier, or is there a little bit more to this story? And then I started digging into the scientific literature, the history, and just kind of keeping mind of all the, like, commentary around the dogs. And I realized there was this enormous firestorm where you had animal experts saying, this is hype, this is not true, you know, dogs of any breed can become dangerous. We need to look at human-dog interactions, and that's where the useful information is going to come from. And so by the time we adopted Nola, I had already started doing some of that research, but then having a connection to a particular dog and living with one and seeing other people's reactions to her really kind of solidified it for me. I thought, wow, there's just so much here to talk about with critical thinking and skepticism and stereotypes.
I guess what's interesting too about that, even with having started a little bit to think in those terms before adopting, well, is that once you had her and you had this reaction to her and people had that reaction to her, and you thought, well, geez, I really want to go further, and it does serve as a catalyst for the project. But then somewhere along the line, I'm not sure where in the process, you had her DNA tested, and then she's not as much a pit as you had originally thought.
Exactly. So I think that was kind of, you know, I guess it's a little bit of a spoiler, but it was almost perfect in a way.
Yeah.
That I had this dog that looked very much a certain way, and everyone had this very strong reaction to her. And a lot of people had a strong positive reaction. Sometimes the negative interactions kind of stick out in your head, but there were lots of people who actually wanted to meet her because they were interested in pit bulls. But the idea that it's even hard to define what they are, no two people can seem to agree on how to define pit bulls, and there are so many mixed breed dogs that are labeled pit bulls, it really kind of all fell into place perfectly when I discovered that, yes, she is, you know, a quarter Amstaff, a quarter Staffordshire Bull Terrier, a quarter random terrier mix, and then a quarter Australian Shepherd. Now, I mean, to be fair, like, the DNA test, that's a consumer product dealing with statistical probabilities, but it's really, it really was kind of perfect that there were these genetic signatures from other breeds in there.
That's what I mean about it. It's really just so emblematic of some of the very issues that we'll discuss and that you cover, obviously, in great detail in the book, because it turns out she wasn't the pit bull or the degree to which you thought she was. And part of how I really got interested in this sort of issue some years ago is Stacy Coleman, who you interview in the book from Animal Farm Foundation. I try to go to conferences and stuff just to stay up and troll for guests and things. And she was doing this lecture, and part of it was a little PowerPoint where she showed a number of dogs, and people in the audience were invited to guess which were pits, which weren't. So there's a number of dogs that had sort of the classic pit things, and then there were some other dogs. And then there was a dog that looked like the yellow lab that we have at home now, And that dog had more pit in terms of DNA, et cetera, than the more classically looking pit that had just been on the slide before. Kind of surprised people in that lecture hall more, including myself. But that's just a measure, I guess, of how blurry and confusing it is in terms of what constitutes a pit bull and how elusive the term is and how difficult the term is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of one of the most interesting parts of the book for me, was that especially when I was speaking with geneticists and people who do genetics research, they stressed that our understanding of how mixed breed dogs are kind of put together is almost like a Mr. Potato Head understanding. Like, if it has pricked ears, it's probably a shepherd or a husky, or if it has, you know, a certain kind of tail, it must be an Akita, or all, and because that's based on what we can visually see and that's what we understand. But the canine genome is vast, and only a tiny amount of that genome is dedicated to the dog's exterior shape. So the rest is dedicated to things like oxygen metabolism and, you know, how cells age and how ligaments are attached to bones and all kinds of things like that. So it really kind of spun my head around when I realized that we're only looking at the exterior, and yet there's so much more there.
And among the things that this, I think, dovetails with is then when people are trying to identify what sort of dog they've had an encounter with, or what sort of dog did the biting or did the attack or did whatever, they're very hard-pressed to do so, but the shorthand becomes, well, it was a pit bull.
Right, of course. And we know there have been multiple studies now that have confirmed that no two people can agree on what a, quote, pit bull looks like. So, one, the category is so broad to begin with. We always talk about the dogs as though they're one distinct breed from a closed gene pool, like a pedigree breed. And that's just not true. There are at least four pedigree breeds in that category. And this enormous amount of dogs who may or may not have one of those pedigree breeds in their genetic makeup. So when pit bull becomes a dog not otherwise specified, then you're going to have a huge problem with breed identification. And it really nullifies the validity of things like bite statistics.
So this brings us to, by the way, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Bronwyn Dickey, author of Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon, a remarkable book that just came out yesterday. If you'd like to ask Bronwyn a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So Bronwyn, I should suggest, perhaps in no surprise to you, that even before we went on the air, just based on my talking a little bit about interview coming up with you on a music show earlier this morning and some Facebook posts and some other stuff, there was at least a half dozen email questions that came in before the show started today. So some, of course, are from the same people, but, and you probably won't be surprised that at least one is from dogsbite.org. So let's look at some, of course, are not as friendly as they should be, but here's the subject line of one says, correcting Bronwyn's first lie, pit bulls are a breed. So I don't know if you want to respond to that. I mean, it sort of hooks into
it. Unfortunately, that's just not true.
Yeah.
I mean, there are four pedigree breeds, and then this enormous other category of dogs that get lumped in there. That's just not true.
Right, okay. So, and then, well, some of these, unfortunately, are very, very long. So I'll just read another one that I think was from the woman, Julie Wall, from dogsbite.org. I can't read the whole gigantic rest of it, but one, it starts off just asking, please ask Miss Dickey if she can provide a list of ethical pit bull breeders. And then it goes on to, it all starts with the ethical breeder willing to produce a dog with a stable inherited temperament. And then, you know, there's quite a long block of text from there. But, I mean, again, I think we're sort of straying from the very point we started off making here in the conversation. But along your path of research and reporting, what sort of ethical pit bull breeders did you find, or what does that phrase even mean?
Again, that's very subjective. The breeders I spoke to were, by and large, people trying to do right by the dogs. They knew where their dogs were placed. They didn't just kind of crank out litters. Not to say that there aren't those people out there. They certainly are. But I wasn't really focused on breeding. I wasn't focused on one that particular kind of issue. So the people that I met, for instance, as I write about in the book, Diane Jessup was one, and then some of the people, I guess, that I probably met through the ABKC. But I would consider an ethical breeder someone who plans their litters very carefully, health tests their dog, provides for their dogs, knows where their dogs are going. You know, that would be my standard for it.
Yeah.
But also, I wasn't really in out to kind of morally legislate how people should feel about their dogs or what they should do with them. I really wanted to investigate how they felt about their dogs and why they got into pit bulls in the first place and the significance of pit bulls in their lives.
Well, that's the thing. I guess I kind of want to underscore with that point in mind that one of the things I think your book is both significant and stellar is that you were clearly so meticulous in all aspects of it. You clearly researched this like someone preparing their dissertation and also did a great deal of sort of shoe leather reporting. To me, I was mentioning this morning to some friends, the book is like a series of New Yorker pieces with everything that suggests, including their fabled fact-checking department. So, I mean, you've heavily sourced and footnoted the book. You provided a bibliography. So to me, this thing is sort of rock solid and bulletproof. And again, wherever you stand, and we've already acknowledged that pit bulls, the topic is very polarizing, but whether you're pro or anti, and I've yet to meet someone who's in between, I feel that whoever you are and wherever you stand, you're a little bit undereducated if you haven't read this book. I mean, I certainly learned a lot, and I feel like I knew quite a bit coming into it. So, in fact, one of the more profound things I learned more about was the role that race played in the story of the pit bull. Can you speak to that a bit, at least partly from the sort of historical framework that you present in the book?
Sure. Well, that was something I became interested in kind of right away when part of what I did, and I'm sure I annoyed lots of strangers, but really everywhere I went in the early months of reporting the book, and pretty much throughout the process, I would just ask a random stranger that I would come across, you know, what do you think of pit bulls? If I was in a restaurant, I would ask the server, what's your opinion on pit bulls? What's your experience? And I just did that over and over and over again, just to kind of get a sense of how, you know, the guy on the street or the woman on the street feels. And what I noticed is that even the people who had pretty strong negative feelings about the dogs, there were fewer of those actually than I expected. But they often would pivot directly to the person they perceived as being behind the dog, and that was the source of their real animosity. So I thought, you know, after a while, I just kept hearing words, you know, coded racial language like thug, gangster, dealer, that kind of thing. It really, when you hear it enough times, you realize there's something going on here. We're using these dogs as a proxy to talk about this kind of culture war. And that really kind of, it became a very important theme in the book. But I saw that over history, that's always been something that was simmering under dog culture in America. Even if you go back to the Civil War or before that, George Washington wrote in a letter to someone that the only reason that, quote, Negroes keep dogs is to aid them in robberies. I mean, it was just this terrible stuff. Slaves were banned from having dogs, it was just kind of that there was this simmering undercurrent of racism, even in American dog culture. So I really wanted to address that. There were lots of people that even asked me not to because it was too sticky and too scary and too controversial for a lot of people. But I felt if I kept seeing it everywhere and I didn't say something, that would be a real social injustice.
And also, too, for a lot of people whose awareness of those kinds of issues might have been spurred by the whole Michael Vick dogfighting ring and some of the things that surrounded that, in a way, would be straight, but you could really sort of draw a bit of a line back decades and decades from some of the issues swirling around that ring, what happened in the wake of his arrest and what happened to those dogs, to all the way back to, like you say, the Civil War and further back than that. So, I mean, it makes, again, it just gives the book that much more heft and complexity to really see in many topics, this one among them, obviously, you know, just the threads that really extend back. In the same way, too, it does seem like the history of pit bulls is sort of cyclical. I mean, if we have enough, a broad enough view, we see in the book the history of the pit bull sort of reflects a number of cycles where pit bulls are embraced and loved, and then they're villainized, then they're viewed quite warmly again, then demonized again. Was that something, as you were pursuing those threads, was that something you expected, or were you surprised by on a graph, kind of the up and down movement on a chart?
I was actually surprised by that. I think because the condensed view of the dog is that they were once beloved and then they were feared. And yet, if you go back even to the first mention of the word bulldog in 1609, even that far back, the dogs were always kind of controversial. They were always seen as, especially because they were generally working class dogs, there were always people who thought they were savage or stupid or whatever, but usually that most had to do with the people who were perceived to own them. So they've always been this kind of lightning rod for cultural tensions in, you know, human society.
Yeah.
And that was really, really interesting to me.
And it was just interesting, too, that we spent some time talking about in the book about sort of their portrayal in Hollywood and other things. So, well, before that, you really just see these fairly distinct cycles. And how would you characterize the current phase in that the cycling of pit bull perception?
Oh, I think it's definitely turning. I think it's definitely turning more toward the positive.
Yeah? How so?
Yeah. I mean, I really do. I think we know so much more about animal behavior now than we ever have. We know how important the interaction kind of how important it is to examine the dogs in the context of their human environment is. And I think people, especially in an information age, I think people are a little weary of being told to be afraid of everything. In the 1980s, when the hysteria around the dogs reached its all-time height, it was not a good time for critical thinking in general. There was the satanic panic that was brewing at the same time, where there were hundreds and hundreds of articles in the American media about how satanic cults were kidnapping children and abusing them for satanic rituals, which did not happen. Stranger danger, where it was where the numbers of children who were thought to be abducted off the street by strangers was wildly inflated. And people were afraid to let their children play outside, these kinds of things. I mean, and even in responses to very real, grave social problems were met with fear and hysteria. Just look at the way we treated people who had contracted the AIDS virus. It was not a good time for critical thinking. It was a time for scapegoating and a time for sensationalism and a time for hysteria. And I think as we move past that, we can look back 20 years and say, you know, we can look at the errors that were made. But people are weary of that now. We can arm ourselves with a lot more information than we've ever been able to.
Well, that's really interesting because obviously became complete expert in this realm and really steeped in all aspects. And again, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that you would have loved to have put in the book that just maybe you felt or your editors felt just, hey, we can't keep going with all this. But it to me, just with everything that goes on, I hear about at the show and generally, I find it really interesting that you think we're heading towards a positive phase because, I mean, I never hear anything like what I hear when the topic of pit bull, I mean, I'm still getting a string of emails, a lot of from the same people. Again, Julie Wall now has said, now is the time to be fair and interview families who have lost a loved one to a horrific pit bull attack, and then gives me information to find out about that and contact that person. And so it goes. So
and honestly, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that.
Yeah.
And I think that was why I reached out to a number of people who were very vocal about wanting pit bulls banned. And I was kind of surprised that so few of them were actually willing to talk to me because I think they do deserve a voice in this conversation. That's completely fine. And the only place where it becomes a problem is when that conversation can't be civil, because we should all come together and talk about facts in a spirit of goodwill rather than name calling or making wild accusations or, you know, trying to smear people online, that kind of thing. And I think, as you point out, a lot of times it's the same people. And so it gives the illusion of, just in terms of volume, there are a small group of people who are very dedicated to this issue, and this is their issue. And they spend a lot of time online in the comment sections of articles having these debates. And I think sometimes it gives the illusion that that sentiment is more widespread than it actually is.
Yeah. Well, there are people that I hear about, hear from regularly. One of those, again, upon hearing that I'd be interviewing you on the show, and when I mentioned it briefly on a music show earlier this morning, wrote in and has written in a number of times, and the subject line says, "Duncan, enough with the pit bulls," and then, "What about the ringing elephants?" and has a bunch of links. And again, I don't know if anyone on the radio dealing with animals has done more about ringing or elephants. You know, I kind of got an elephant obsession. So anyways, nonetheless, there's links to that. But then she says, "Also, why don't you interview Merritt Clifton about pit bulls? At least offer an alternative to the uneducated propaganda. You demonstrate every week that you are not a neutral, objective, or professional journalist." So I can take that hit. That's fine. But it did make me think that you had a fairly interesting account of your experience with Merritt Clifton. I don't know if you want to review any of that now.
I mean, you know, it's a short piece in the book.
Yeah.
But I reached out. Merritt was one of the people that I reached out to because he has been so passionate about this subject for so long, and he does present himself as an expert on it. And so I did want to talk to him, and I actually really wanted to hear his story and why he felt so strongly about this. And so, because as I said before, I really did not want to present a one-sided view of such a complex issue. That would have not been intellectually honest. That would have not been true. It's just not the kind of work I do. I think the subject is a lot richer when you have competing voices offering different views. So I did reach out to him, and he sent me back a pretty nasty email, which surprised me, since we had never interacted before. But I think that's kind of his persona. I think that's kind of what he did. But I thought, how unfortunate, because for any journalist out there who's never been involved in this issue, if they're evaluating sources, and on the one side are credentialed animal professionals who have degrees in the animal sciences, who are drawing from peer-reviewed research in a calm, reasoned way, and on the other side, you have people kind of impugning your motives or sending nasty emails or hiding from a conversation, not substantiating anything with citations, that kind of thing. If you didn't know anything about the subject, it's pretty obvious which side you would think was more legitimate. So I also just think, in terms of their activism, I would hope for them that they would kind of see how that comes across in the larger media landscape. And if I had possession of knowledge, which I truly believed would save lives, I certainly wouldn't hide that from someone, even if the person might not disagree with me. I would think you would want to shout it from the mountaintops.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but, you know, it's everybody's a little different. And as you say, these things ignite really strong passion.
Well, it is interesting because it is an area where you would think that if, and again, I mean, I think I've made this clear. I mean, you really approach this as a journalist with a totally even-handed way. And so there is all kinds of views represented, all kinds of research, all kinds of reporting. So I think a couple of these emails that came in referred to you as an advocate, which I don't think applies. I mean, you're you know.
Yeah, I don't consider myself a pit bull advocate at all. And
yeah.
So it's interesting kind of when you put a work out there, how people kind of see in it what they want to see in it.
Yeah.
But I really, I don't advocate for any type of dog over another. I think I advocate for critical thinking, and I certainly advocate for a greater understanding between humans and animals so that we can all build better, safer, and more humane communities for everybody. But, you know, it's funny, a lot of times people will come up to me and say, you know, just they'll say in this very shy and almost like sheepish way, sorry, you know, I'm afraid of those dogs. I'm just afraid of pit bulls. And I say, that's completely fine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not out there telling people that, you know, everyone has to love pit bulls or something, or everyone has to go adopt one or anything like that. Absolutely not. I just trace kind of the evolution of how we've thought about them over time. And I certainly do not defend the actions of any dog that has injured somebody, or, you know, any dog that's unstable or whatever. I think I've been charged with kind of, quote, like, excusing dogs that have individual dogs that have caused serious injuries to people, and I say absolutely not. Oh my gosh, I don't want to live next to a dog that I'm terrified of. I don't want to be afraid walking down my street that a dog is going to run out and, you know, harm me or my pets. I don't want that either, and I don't care what kind of dog it is. So I think, yeah, it's interesting how people kind of sweep me into whatever box they want to put me in.
Right, which is, again, why I think the book is so important, because, again, all these very high-level journalistic tenets have been observed in putting the book together. And as someone who spent most of my life working in media one kind or another, I was really distressed to learn that not only is poor reporting, lazy, kind of sloppy, glib stuff that I've known about in more recent years, accounted for much of the hysteria and anti-pit bull sentiment, I guess, but that this sort of slipshod work or even purposeful sensationalism was part of the media landscape decades ago. I mean, some of the things you talked about as far as fairly prestigious outlets like Sports Illustrated or especially the New York Times making a number of errors or not really doing accurate, smart reporting that you would associate with them. And then, of course, those things get perpetuated over time because people go back and look at clips or whatever and say, well, yeah, back then this is what happened according to the New York Times. And it's pretty disillusioning.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's just, in all fairness, you know, and as a journalist myself, we are human beings. We're not oracles.
Yeah.
We all make mistakes. And there were certain parts of the story that I never got the sense when things kind of initially started, when that to snowball in the media, I really didn't get the sense that anyone was out to get the dogs or out to create a panic or anything like that. I really didn't. But again, it's just one thing builds on another. And the lesson for me in that, when I kind of look at it from my own stuff, is to, especially, no matter who you're talking to for a story, you know, not to let someone who is not a scientist make broad stroke scientific claims and then not challenge those claims.
Yeah.
Like, let's leave science to the scientists, for sure.
Right. Well, that's why, again, I think the approach that you outlined for us at the beginning here about the three threads, historical, scientific, and social, were so important, because without a balance of those running throughout the book, yeah, we'd obviously there'd be things that would be left out or things that would be unrepresented or disproportionately represented. And yeah, I think you're right about the journalists doing those accounts. I just think sometimes they're on deadline or, you know, there's any number of factors of why maybe something isn't as precisely reported as it should be. But then again, those things do get carried through, and then they're part of the statistics and links that I get in the studio email on a day like today. And so let's take, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, but let's take at least one call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Bronwyn Dickey. Hello, it's you. Go ahead. Hello. Oh, maybe they got tired of waiting. Okay, so in our final moment or two here, let me ask, what is your threshold when it comes to discussing your family's literary legacy?
What do you mean by threshold?
Well, are you comfortable talking about it? Do you like talking
sure.
about it? No, okay.
Sure. That's sure.
Okay, so your dad was James Dickey, the poet and novelist, best known perhaps to many for writing Deliverance. So how did growing up with a writer of that stature influence your own career path?
When I was growing up, I never thought I would be a writer. I always enjoyed writing, but Dad achieved so much he worked at such a high level that I never thought writing was something that I would do. I probably thought I might go into the law or maybe get a PhD in English or something like that.
Hmm.
But he very much influenced me early on in terms of always putting books in my hands and always encouraging me to ask questions and investigate things and never to be content to just kind of read about something from afar, but to go check it out or to try to do it yourself. So that was a tremendous influence. But yeah, I never, it kind of snuck up on me a little bit after college. When
That's
I thought,
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think because I just kind of wanted to go my own way.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have a shadow to live in.
Yeah.
But I think once I kind of realized that writing was what I wanted to do, especially with nonfiction, there are so many opportunities that are completely different from anything anyone in my family does. You know, my brother is a journalist as well, but he does a very different kind of journalism.
Sure.
He writes about politics and terrorism in the Middle East and very hard-hitting news that way.
Yeah.
So, but with journalism, it's just such a wide-open field, and it's such a wonderful way to indulge one's curiosities.
For sure. And, you know, Bronwyn, it's funny what you remember. In high school, English, which for me was a long time ago, our teacher showed us a film about your dad. I think we were studying his poetry at the time. And in the film, he said something that has stayed with me ever since. I mean, I was more of a writer than I am now, and hopefully going to circle back to that. But there was this quote that, I mean, I can't remember what else happened throughout high school probably, but this has always stayed with me. He said, and I think this actually might be verbatim, but it's darn close, "I work and work and work on my writing to get that worked on look out of it." And I thought, wow.
Yes, he said that all the time.
Okay,
yes,
well, there you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And so he was not about, you know, he didn't sit around waiting for the muse.
Yeah.
Whatever. He got up at 6 a.m. every day. He played a little music on guitar, and he headed straight to the typewriter, and he just worked and worked and worked. And he gave me a real appreciation for how much of it is craft rather than, you know, magical inspiration.
Right. Yeah. Artwork. No, that's a great work ethic to see up close, especially when it's producing the kind of work that he did. So, yeah, very cool. Well, we're going to try one more call, and then we're sort of at the end of our time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Bronwyn Dickey.
Hello.
Hello. Quick question or comment. We're sort of at the end of our time. Do you have a quick question or comment for Bronwyn? Go ahead, please.
Okay. The four breeds that are classified as pit bulls, and then I had a comment about I had a Staffordshire Terrier, and I was told that the first 12 were brought to the United States in, like, the Depression. And, like, Petey from the Little Rascals was one of them, and the RCA Victor dog was another. And they started breeding and crossbreeding them for fighting or whatever that created the actual pit bull or whatever. I just wondered. Thank you.
Okay,
Sorry,
caller, you still there?
Pardon me?
Okay, I'm sorry. Just to clarify, your question is about those dogs being pits or what breed or what? I'm sorry?
Yep. Staffordshire Terriers.
Okay, you're trying to verify if they were Staffordshire Terriers?
Yeah, there were 12 of them. I believe one of them was Petey from the Little Rascals, and the other one was the RCA Victor dog listening for his master's voice.
Okay.
But I wonder if that's true.
Okay, thank you for your call.
So, the first part of your question, I think originally you asked about the four breeds that are considered pit bull breeds. That would be the American Pit Bull Terrier, the American Staffordshire Terrier, which was kind of the confirmation breed that branched off from the American Pit Bull Terrier in the 1930s. Then the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, which is much more popular in the United Kingdom. It's a much smaller dog. And then the newer American Bully, which was derived from the American Staffordshire Terrier in the 90s. So those were the four pedigree breeds that are in that category. And yes, you are correct. Petey from the Little Rascals was an American Pit Bull Terrier. I believe he was also, it might not have been Petey, actually, but right in that generation of dog, the American Pit Bull Terriers were also used to set the physical standard for the American Staffordshire Terrier, the AKC confirmation breed. The RCA Victor dog, we have very few primary source documents about him, but his name was Nipper, and Emil Berliner, who the grandson of the man who invented the gramophone, described him as a bulldog with a considerable amount of terrier in him. So, that's something that I'm sure in a shelter today would get labeled a pit bull. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, No pedigree there.
Right. Well, and again, there's so many things in the book, including some of the Hollywood dogs that we just didn't have time to. And you made reference to a woman who I really was hoping to talk a little bit more about, Diane Jessup, but we are sort of at the end of our time. I've been speaking with Bronwyn Dickey. Her new book is Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Wherever you get your books, you can get this one. She also has a website, Bronwyn Dickey, Bronwen Dickey.com. Bronwyn, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. In a few moments, I'll chat briefly with Linda Hamilton, the head honcho of Animal Coalition of Tampa, whose spaghetti fundraiser and special anniversary celebration takes place on Saturday in Ybor City. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner after that conversation with Bronwyn. It's almost incumbent on me to play this classic piece. This is Bill Burr with a piece called, yes, Pitbull, in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
So I got a dog recently. That's a big thing in my life. I went down to the pound and I got a free dog. That's how I say it. I don't say I rescued a dog. All right, it's obnoxious and it's not true. Sick of people doing that. She's a rescue. Yeah, I rescued her. Really? Did you pull her out of a burning building? Did you jump in a river with your wingtips still on, with no concern for your own safety? Or did you just go down to the pound and get a free dog? Stop acting like you had to take out a couple of guards, crawling on your elbows, using hand signals. Dude, you ever go down to the pound, they're just giving the dogs away. They don't even do a background check. They're just like, you want them? Get out of here. Who's next? So, my girlfriend actually, to be honest with you, got the dog while I was traveling. I was in a different state. My girlfriend got us a dog, right? Classic female move, you know? That's just a 10 to 15 year commitment. Why would you include me in that decision? So, we're Skyping. I go, well, let me see the dog. I thought she got some little cute little chihuahua or something. She pans around, and I'm looking at like this hellhound. Yeah, I'm like freaking out. Like, is that a pit bull? Please tell me you didn't get a pit bull. And she's like, it's not a pit bull. They said it was a mix. Mixed with what? Another pit bull? Look at that thing. Oh, it was brutal. Should have seen it. Looked like I've been doing pull-ups its entire life. Front paws were still taped up and shadow boxing. Teardrop tattoo. It's a pit bull. But here's the funny thing. I fell in love with the dog. I know a lot of people don't like pit bulls because they ate a couple of guys. I get it. It's been some issues. But you owe it to yourself at some point in your life to walk down the street with a pit bull. I'm telling you, people just get out of the way. It's awesome. 3-4 blocks away, they see me coming, they just start crossing the street. I love it. My whole life, I've looked like Ron Howard. Okay? I've been mugged repeatedly. But the second they see that four-legged P90X body coming down the street, oh, yeah. It's the greatest dog you could ever have. Having a pit bull, it's like having a gun you can pet. It's tremendous. I'm out of time. You guys are a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
All right, that was Bill Burr with a piece called Pitbull, taken from a Letterman appearance a few years back. Let's move, I unfortunately was not able to reach Linda Hamilton of Animal Coalition of Tampa. I tried a few different numbers and got voicemail everywhere. But I just want to at least highlight some things that we would have talked about. And that's that their big spaghetti dinner fundraiser is coming up this Saturday in Ybor City at the Spaghetti Warehouse, I think. It's also an anniversary of ACT. I think it's their 10th year anniversary, and they'll also be celebrating a lot of low-cost spay and neuters. There'll be, of course, dinner and silent auction, and going to be dogs there that'll be doing painting and other things, and I think one of the dogs that maybe had a milestone procedure will be there. But also, the thing I was going to reveal through Linda, but she's not here, is the evening's going to be hosted by our own fabulous Flea. Yeah, WMNF Flea is going to be the host and MC that night. So, going to be really, really fun. and raising money for a great cause, Animal Coalition of Tampa. I know many, many people have taken their cats and dogs there for low-cost spay and neuter and other medical procedures. So find out more by going to actampa.org and find out about this Saturday's big event, Spaghetti, right? Okay, you got that. Dinner fundraiser this Saturday. And so it's time now to move into Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, Talking Animal shirt, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663. And correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks, gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Well, let's see. We seem to have a full phone bank lit up. Let's take them in. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Werewolves of London.
Okay, you're on the air live on WNF. What is your name, sir?
Andy from Dunedin.
Andy, all right. You are our winner. I'm going to put your call back on hold, and we'll get your information and send you off a Talking Animals t-shirt. Thanks.
Great, thanks.
All right, folks, so we do have a winner, and we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Coming up, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity at 11 o'clock, rolling into the noon hour. It constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. I'm Duncan Strauss. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition of the show. I hope you'll join me. Also, visit TalkingAnimals.net, where you can find archives, audio archives of every show we ever broadcast, iTunes Podcast 2. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and might even be better to like me personally as well as the show. Follow us on Twitter. All that stuff's available on TalkingAnimals.net. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.